So I have about the same issue you had last week that I don't really know what to talk. Well, I do. Well, of course, I know what to talk about, but
but I guess it's going to be accessibility.
No. Well, yeah. So I had two topics that I was in doubt about. So either about performance, or, and this one, it's going to be, we're going to talk about testing.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. So,
yeah.
Should we test our designs?
No.
Well, good.
No, I'm joking.
That's
no. Of course we should. Yeah, but how testing to me is in the same way as performance in a sense. It's like really. The answer is so simple, yet it seems so complicated to actually get anything done with it. It seems to get lost in the whatever standard processes that are out there. Unless, you know, part of my job, we do product development, and so we do some designs, and so we talk about what we want to do, we design something, we sort of test it, quote unquote, in-house. You know, we make a prototype, click through it, everybody gets some input, we show it to people, and then we kind of iterate a little bit, and then we build whatever the thing is, like a prototype. And then maybe we not release it, but, you know, like soft launch it or something. So we have something that's actually built, hooked up to a database, and then we test it some more. And then when we want to do something or we want to get real feedback, we release it to, you know, a few thousand users maybe. Then we get proper data and it's great, and we iterate from there on. And that process, I think, is really good. We're missing a step in there where we show it to 50 users, for example. Although we sometimes use the, what's it called, usability hubs, kind of online testing thing. I've used that a few times just to test simple prototypes. You know, do you know where to click next? That sort of thing. But to me, this is a good process. It works, but I think it works because it's a small team. We do product development. There's no sort of necessarily deadlines or budget constraints. You know, we work until it's kind of ready. We test it. We do some more. We can always come back and change it, basically. And we're all on board with this one product. The other jobs I do when I work with clients, I'm beholden to whatever process is out there and whatever budget is there and whatever deadline and whatever CMS and whatever developers. There's always something that I can't control. And testing seems to be, for the most part, we just do it in-house. You know, a very common process is I speak to the client, I get some requirements, we do some sketches, we show the sketches to a development partner, they give us a quote. We go back to the client, they say, okay, that sounds good. We start designing more. We sort of finish it again, quote unquote. Client's happy. We send it over to the developers. And then a few weeks later, they say, okay, it's up on staging for you to test. So somehow it's like it's on the client to test their own product. Okay. Yep. That's one thing. And not only that, we're also testing then to see, did they implement it correctly? Are the buttons where they should be? Does everything work? It's not really user testing in terms of the user experience. It's more like quality assurance testing.
Okay. Yeah.
I'm waffling now.
No, but really good. So there's many, many aspects that you already covered there. Really good. So there's all kinds of testing, of course. So good to hear that in your product work, you do some usability testing and user testing or testing with humans. That's really good, I guess. Because in my memory from when I worked, before I became a lecturer, we never really tested. So there were a few people at the organization where I worked who really wanted to test. So there was a guy who was actually setting up a test lab. But
yeah,
to be honest, we never really tested. And everything was based on prior experience. So
yeah,
we know this works. Or we assume this works, and we'll implement it again. Or this looks cool, we'll implement it.
Yeah,
something like that. That was the process. And I'm not sure if things have changed, but I do, to be honest, I think that's the main process in most organizations still.
So, I agree. I don't have I've worked for a handful of companies and obviously, you know, maybe hundreds of clients, and that's kind of it. But my impression is, without ever having worked at any of these bigger product companies, is that once you do product, you kind of have to test more just by, you know, your whole business falls apart if this product doesn't work properly.
Yeah.
And everybody knows developing a product, no matter how simple you think it is, it takes a long time and you're going to hit stumbling blocks even internally. So I think there's almost naturally built into the process, there's some testing. You need, at some point, you need to build a prototype and put it out there.
Yeah.
And then you get feedback, right?
Yeah. So what you see a lot is A-B testing or even ABC testing, or how you call it, multivariable testing.
Yeah.
That's something that I think happens a lot at large products. But human testing, I'm not, they should be doing it. I don't know. So what I see at my university, at least, is we tell our students you have to test with real people. And then the people they test with are their parents, and they're just the student who's sitting next to them.
Yeah.
And it's not real testing, of course. I mean, it's better than nothing. You get some feedback.
Yeah.
But I always tell them, just you travel by train, ask the person next to you in the train what they think about it. Do they understand it? Right? That's a much better test than asking your parents, who are probably really proud of what you're doing, right?
Yeah. To be honest, I think parents are, it's better to ask your parents than your colleagues.
Yeah.
For starters, yeah. Right? If you ask your colleagues or your fellow students, you're likely to get someone who's similar to you in at least one big way, which is, you know, they know design or development or whatever it is that you do.
Yeah.
You're going to get someone from the same perspective.
Yeah.
If you ask, you can ask a colleague across the organization, like someone in that works in accounting, or, you know, someone just outside of the project often helps.
Yeah.
And this, at least in my experience, this happens like a lot. I usually do this, you know, I get a second opinion.
Yeah.
Now that I work from home, I get second opinions from my wife and my daughter, which is invaluable sometimes, although my daughter has a tendency to, she's too afraid to hurt my feelings. So she's like, oh yeah, no, this is great. It's really easy. I understand it. Whereas actually what I want is, you know, I want people to point out where the flaws are. My wife's really good at that.
Yeah. Katrin, my wife as well, really good. I make stuff, I ask her, do you get it? And she destroys everything I make. It's just
but that's great.
Yeah.
But then the question I think is, you ask one person who is not a designer or a developer, who's also not invested in your product or project or whatever the thing you're making, so you get a really, really valuable opinion. And of course, if that is actually this bit here, I don't get it, like, why is that like that, you know, explain it to me, then you have something to you know, improve, which is great.
Mm-hmm.
But how many people, that's only still only one opinion, right? If you ask 10 people, you might get 10 opinions and they might be different. If you ask 100, but you, what I'm getting at is, I think the more people you ask, the more clearly you can see a pattern in the feedback. So if you only ask one or two or three, you can get some feedback, but maybe there's no clear pattern. Maybe it's harder to understand what the biggest thing to fix is or how to prioritize what you do next. So is there a golden number of how many people you need to involve?
I think there's even a number which says 5 is enough.
Mm.
With 5, you have probably 80% or 90% of the issues.
Mm.
You found them. And I think a simple number is 1 is better than none.
Yep.
And then a few is better than 1. And then, but don't waste your time on asking 10 people when you found lots of issues, lots of obvious issues that you didn't see before.
Exactly. You might as well weed those out before you branch out. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. So I think at most five.
More than five is a waste of time. Almost right.
Maybe not, but I don't know. I think five is enough. Yeah.
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 I think the what we're getting at is, you know, more than yourself, already you've done a big job. You know, get someone outside of the project and then you get valuable feedback. Yeah. And if you multiply that by five, it's really, really good.
Yeah. And what I found is that it gets even more interesting when you test with people who are not behind their computers all day.
Mm.
Because we are, I mean, I look at my computer screen just all day from the morning till I go to sleep. But there are many people who don't do that. But they do use our products. So they do depend on what we make. I mean, they have to use it. And I think these are people that are harder to design for. They don't know the patterns that we use, for instance. They're not obvious to everybody. So, and I think when you test with these real people, maybe we could call them normal people, then you find stuff that, the unknown unknowns. I found that really interesting. So testing with my neighbors, for instance, and they come up with stuff, just observing them, and it's just, wow, but it's obvious. There's the button.
Click the bloody thing.
No, it's just not there.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that's something that we tend to forget, that there's just normal people using our products.
Yeah, because we have, like you said earlier on there, there's a tendency to design from assumption. And let me be the first to say that, of course, we have to design from assumption. I mean, I've been doing this 15 years. What else am I going to design from, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. I got to make decisions.
Yeah, yeah.
But I guess if you rely on that and only that, you're missing out on all these quirky, weird, normal perspectives. In a sense that we have websites that we visit and we see, oh, I need a pattern for this drop down menu. How do people do that again? And then maybe you visit your favorite products that you go to every day. You check out how YouTube does it, and oh, in Gmail they do it like this. And there's all these tools that we maybe assume that everybody not only uses, but they use them a lot.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I think obviously working on the web, we use them more than most. So there's maybe 50 patterns that we think everybody knows really, really well.
Yeah.
And like you say, they don't.
No. Yeah. Yeah. So this is something, of course, that I've been, from an accessibility point of view, I've been testing with real people as well. And I had the assumption that if you just used proper semantics in your website, a website would be accessible to, for instance, people with a screen reader. And then when I tested it with some real nerdy screen reader users, so real, real power nerds. And indeed, they just confirmed what I thought, and they just raced through the website. Yeah. But then I tested it with a normal person who turned blind a few years ago.
Yeah.
And just, it was such a pain to look at. So the first thing we did when, so he showed me, so I just asked him some of the important stuff that you have to do. Can you show me how you do that? So he said, okay, I'll show you. I have to do some banking. He had to send 2,000 euros, quite a lot of money. He had to send it from one bank account to another bank account. So he logged into his online banking environment and he just couldn't do it. There was no way that he could send 2,000 euros from one account to the other. It was impossible. So I did it for him. Can you imagine that? That this total stranger comes into your house and the first thing you ask him to do is, can you please send 2,000 euros to. And I won't look, right?
Yeah.
So a normal thing like sending money, which shouldn't be that complicated. There are some steps involved, of course, and there are some, but that was impossible. Then ordering groceries, impossible. But also just reading the news. So it was just such a horrible experience. My whole web view, the view that I had of the web, the idea that the web is accessible to everybody, it just collapsed on that day. And
so this was a bit of sort of general research where you asked about, you know, not your own designed products, but, you know, the web in general.
So I was just observing, just looking at, so I was trying to find things to solve. And then it turned out that everything was broken.
Everything needs fixing. Yeah.
That was just too much work to be done. and then there's smaller things, like for instance, there's lots of paradoxes as well within this kind of research. So for instance, from one point of view, it makes total sense to put the navigation at the top of the page because people are used to the navigation being on top of the page. So when they look for the navigation, they know where to find it. So that's an argument to put the navigation at the top of the page. But then I tested with a blind friend of mine again. Or I didn't even test. He wanted to show me his own website, and he wanted to show me a page in his website. And he had to go, he just was tabbing through the whole navigation, and these drop-down menus, they just opened up. And it took him more than a minute to reach this page.
And on his own website?
On his own website. And then he came on this next page, and he wanted to play, there was a sound file on this page, and he wanted to let me hear that sound file. And then he had to tap through the whole navigation again because it was at the beginning of the page. And so power screen reader users will tell me, but you can just skip to the content, or you can use headings instead of tabbing through everything.
Yeah.
But he's not a power user. He's a normal person who uses his computer whenever he needs to use his computer, and the rest of the day he does other stuff. So he doesn't remember all these settings, and he doesn't remember all these keyboard shortcuts. So he had to tap through all this. So it took him at least 2 minutes to get to this audio file, and it was just so painful to look at it. And then when he wanted to play the audio file, it was even worse. This modal dialogue popped up, which said, do you want to download? And then the name of the file, which was a horrible name, something like audio 16 GGGG 5 final real final dot MP3. Yeah. And he didn't understand what was going on. So his solution was restarting the computer. And I saw him restart the computer. I asked him, how many times do you restart the computer a day? Well, at least 10 times. That was just a normal thing to do.
It's a real insight into how I think technology in general is just not geared up for fringe cases, if you can call them that.
Yeah, you know?
Yeah. I get a glimpse of this when I'm out driving. I just put my phone in this little holder, and I use it for sat-nav, and I use it for music as well. And there's a law in the UK where you can't touch your phone whilst you're driving, even to change the music, really.
Yeah.
So I rely on Siri. It's the only time I actually use Siri for anything, and it's to either find a place in the maps or to play some music. And being a Norwegian with a Norwegian accent... it's sometimes really hard. So I've had to make a playlist, and that's the only thing really that I play. Some albums are easier to find than others, but I have a playlist. It's called Brunborg Favorites. That's what I play, because I've trained myself to talk to Siri in a way that she understands exactly this playlist. So, you know, it's super frustrating, and you're doing 50 miles down the road, and obviously it's just music. You can just not play it, or there may be someone else in the car that can play the music for you. So it's easy to see how it just compounds if it's not something simple as playing a single playlist, but transferring 2,000 euros to someone and getting the bank account number correct.
Yeah. So, well, I think there's lots of testing to be done there. And there's a strange thing that in the accessibility world, I don't think there's very much of this kind of testing going on. Because if there were, we would have a completely different story. I mean, we wouldn't hear you just use semantics and things work fine. We would hear a very different story, or a more nuanced story. There's just not much testing going on there, if I think. And I do this testing with my students as well. So the first thing I let them just work with one person with a real disability. And it's really confronting. So these are third year students. It's the third year. It's the final course they get during their, I mean, after that it's just final exams and an internship. So it's the final last course of the university. And in this course, they just learn that everything they've learned so far is not true.
Perfect. So perfect to put that at the end.
Yeah. So they make a prototype. So, for instance, for a friend of mine who is severely motor disabled, so he has to use his keyboard. Well, that's at least the assumption. So they design this prototype to work perfectly well with a tap key, so you can tap through everything. And then it turns out that he never uses his tap key. Because we decided not to design focus states on the web a few years ago. So the tap key is broken anyway.
Yeah.
So he uses a different way to navigate through pages. So their first assumption, their first prototype, is just fails miserably. And it's based on web best practices. It's based on what I have taught them in previous courses. It's based on what the accessibility world tells them to do, right? Design well-designed focus states. And then it turns out this guy never uses them. And then they test with a blind person, and they learn, you have to add semantics. And this person just hates semantics. He doesn't know what it means. He just doesn't understand what's a heading level, what's a navigation. Yeah. These are nerdy words, right?
Yeah.
Why do you put these words in your design?
That's what
he asks us. So he thinks these are visible to us, these words.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. Because they're visible to him.
Yeah.
Yeah. Let me ask you this, because this is a real sort of reality shattering feedback that you're getting, or these students of yours are getting, right?
Yeah.
And in my experience, designers can be a bit sensitive sometimes to feedback, you know, whether it's peer or teacher feedback or client feedback as well. Sometimes designers have this tendency to sort of dig in a bit, because maybe they spent, you know, the best part of a week getting all the semantics right. So my question is, do you get sometimes students then who get defensive and maybe blame the user or kind of go, well,
no, not,
I hear
not
what you're saying,
course.
But, you know, these semantics are the way they should be. No.
Well, not really in this course, because after one day they test. So after a few hours of work, they have their first test.
Oh, right.
Test,
yeah. Okay.
Right.
Yeah.
So there's no, they cannot get attached to their design yet.
See what you mean.
It's
yeah.
just you make a prototype and you test. And then the next week you have a second prototype and you test again. So it's all the time it's testing with this real person. So there's no time to get attached to your design. I've seen that before. And that was just incredible. So I was working for a large Dutch airline company. And so they, of course, the main thing of their website was buying tickets. But they also had a large part of the website which was just content, important content, or just things to read. But somehow, I don't really know why, but somehow they thought that these pages were not visited enough. So instead of hiring a content strategist or a content expert, they hired a advertising agency. And the advertising agency came up with a brilliant idea to make a rich content footer on every page.
Okay.
So, and this was, so they did all these productions. So they went with film crews to designers, and they made all these movies. And then the idea was to put all these movies into an animating footer, a large footer with all these things in, but at the bottom of each page. This was their brilliant idea. And they had been working on these productions, these movies, for months. And then they came up with this beautiful animated thing, and it would have to go whoosh and whoosh and whoosh. And but this was back in the IE6 time, right? And then they said, okay, we have to test this. So okay, so I'll make a prototype. But first I said, this is just a silly idea. I mean, it's in the footer. Nobody's going to see it. Why do you spend so much money on a footer? Then they said, no, this is a brilliant idea and we have to do this. So I made a prototype and it kind of works, but not really. I mean, it worked in that single browser that was best at that time. And then we made a test, and they just tried to let people find that footer, but nobody found the footer. And then they said, make a banner and put it in the middle of the content. So I made a banner, put it in the middle of the content during the test. And then you had this eye tracking, so you can see where people were watching, they were looking. So somebody was reading the text, and then he came at the banner, and he just looked around it. he just skipped it. He literally looked around it and then continued reading. So it was just everything in that test showed us that it was just a disaster, a complete disaster. Nobody found the footer, and when somebody by chance encountered the footer, they just didn't understand it at all what they was doing there. And then the art director said, that was brilliant, let's continue. And that was it. It just completely ignored the test. Somehow he just flipped it to being a complete success. And they threw a few more 100,000 euros at it. And it was just a complete disaster. Nobody ever saw it. It was ridiculous.
It was a sunk cost fallacy. They spent so much already, and this data is too damaging to us, so we're just going to pretend it never happened.
Yeah.
It sounds like at some point there was maybe we spoke about assumptions earlier on. I think someone with a different perspective, i.e. in this case your perspective, the assumption would have been that this is a failed mission to begin with. Mm-hmm. You know, the core idea isn't really there, because you're on an airline website. Why would you try and make something really fancy happening in the footer? That's just not really.
Mm-hmm. But there were more than, so I said from the beginning, we shouldn't do this. This is ridiculous. But of course the advertising agency didn't want to hear that. But my colleagues didn't want to hear that as well, because it was a big project and we needed the money. And I thought, no, don't waste money on this crap. It doesn't make any sense. It's not something that we're going to be proud of. Don't waste our time, right? Yeah. They took me off the project after that.
Yeah, rocking the boat, Vasilis.
So, yeah, testing. But, I mean, if you test often and you test early, then it doesn't hurt. If you test later on in the project and you've spent lots of money and lots of hours and you begin to love the project and then you get negative feedback, then it hurts. So that's too late to test, basically.
Yeah, in a sense, yeah. Or you just got to develop an attitude. I think it depends on the thing you're working on too. Like I said earlier, sometimes you use this usability hub and it's like, obviously, in a sense, it's great. I test on 10, 20 people and it's just a single or maybe two questions. Like, hey, you landed on this screen. You want to book, you want to find the latest movie. Where do you click?
Yeah.
And that's really useful because sometimes it goes completely to your assumption where, I'm not that bad a UX designer. I made a big button that says find a movie and people go, find a movie. But you also get like people clicking in the weirdest places. And maybe it doesn't lead you to change things radically, but you change a word or something just to clarify things or make it a little bit, easier to understand. And that sort of stuff, it's easy to do often. It's sometimes hard to sort of find out what warrants a test. If you work on something for half an hour, do you test it or do you just kind of go, nah, that's probably fine, and then you test more later on? But I think at least for us, the bigger tests, it's like it's really, really hard to do online in some sort of form. Usability Hub, you submit the pictures, you put hotspots on, you write questions to go with each screen, and you kind of guide the person through it. And that's fine for these kind of preference tests or very simple instructions tests. But as a whole, like we're working on a browser extension, for example, we know that it works technically. We know that it's easy enough to use, but we don't know if this is something that people want or if how do we integrate this extension into people's daily surfing life. And that's I think you only can really test it by launching it. You don't have to spend 2 million euros in advertising, but you have to actually make it. You have to show it to some people. You have to convince them to install it. And then you have to just see, not so much by calling them up, but seeing the data, seeing how they actually interact with it. Are they using it? Do they come back to it the next day to see if it actually is something people want? Yeah. And at that point, you have invested a lot of time. So if it doesn't work, you're sweating.
Yeah, that's true. So that's why you have something like minimum viable product, right? That you launch it right whenever it's the first minimal product is ready, you just launch it to check if it works. Yeah,
if it actually is, yeah, viable.
Yeah.
I think people should adopt that more when it comes to just your average website as well. The issue with at least the process I've been involved with is that it comes down to the single launch, single budget thing. You only have enough to make the thing once. So essentially, no matter how much time you put into it, you are making a prototype because it's not existed before. So you launch it, and then if it doesn't work as well as you hoped, or if there's a big mistake that wasn't spotted by whomever, well, that's kind of it. I mean, obviously, if it's a bug, you got to fix it. But if the product just isn't as good as it could be, you're not going to get another chance the next week to do iteration 2, which, of course, in product design, you would. Of course you would. You would just keep working on it continuously.
Yeah.
And I don't really know how to convince people that this is how they need to part with their money. Part with a little bit less at the time, but be aware that you need to do it 4 times before website is good.
Yeah, it's really hard to convince people to do that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, they say, no, just start with homepage. No.
Yeah. Even just designing something simple can be difficult because it looks boring. Where's the pictures we spent loads of money taking? But
okay, but good. I'm happy to hear that you do testing on different parts in the process. Good.
Yeah, I mean, I've historically not tested nearly enough. I've had lots of guilt over not testing enough. But now that we talk about it, I realize, you know, actually, I do test. Even if it's these kind of random tests with family, it helps to get someone else's perspective. I guess that's the that's the crux of it.
Yeah, yeah, that's it. And then accepting the other person's perspective. It can
so
be hard.
Important. Yeah. And not just with hard data, but just generally getting feedback from people is a skill, I think. Yeah. You got to really learn how to deal with it and accept it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that's why I think if you test early or get feedback early, then it doesn't hurt that much. Yeah.
So. Yeah. And that also helps from the money side of things. If you test early when you're still in Figma and you do a sketch, it doesn't cost so much to change it.
It's true. True. Yeah. Okay.
All right, Espen, testing is good.
Testing is good, I guess. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. We haven't really talked about A/B testing, but I don't have really much experience in A/B testing. So.
No, I don't either. But you know what? With A/B testing, that I've always wondered is that if your online shop and you change or a product for that matter, if you do test and you get a difference in or whatever 3% or something, I don't know what would count as significant anyways, because I guess it matters how many users you have in your test, you know. But let's say you get a significant difference that you can prove, and yes, this version B is better than version A. For you need to have a sizable amount of your income directly related to the website for it to be worth it, I feel. You know, Amazon, obviously, 0.05% change is, you know, 20 million euros. Great, you can do that.
Yeah.
But for certainly my average projects, particularly websites for clients, like it's hard to justify any grand project where you invest lots of money in increasing traffic by 3% because it doesn't convert to anything.
No. It's just that's only usable at scale, real scale. Yeah. Mm. And then you need some real good analysts as well. So people who know how to analyze data. I've seen ridiculous conclusions being drawn from data, and then whole designs being based on a ridiculous conclusion from wrong data. Yeah. So that's something that I guess you need when you need some a real good crew to be able to do A/B testing.
I think so. Yeah. The science of setting it up as well. It's just it
needs a lot of documentation as well.
Yeah. And if you want it to be scientific, you got to have controls. It's not that simple.
No.
We tried something recently with some Google adverts for this extension we're making. And as far as I understand, this is set up now in Google Ads where you upload whatever it was, 10, 15, 20 images, and you write 5, 10, 15 different pieces of text. And then you just push publish, and then the algorithm takes care of it. And after a certain period, you know which one performs best. Which, to be honest, sounds like a pretty chill way of doing A/B testing for me. Just let the computer handle it.
Yeah. Not very scientific. I mean, there's no transparency at all.
No.
No way it can be repeated. No.
No. But this one brings in more cash.
Yeah. That's good enough, I guess.
For this,
in this
context, I think it is.
Yeah. Okay.
Alrighty.
That was very interesting again, Espen. Thank you very much for another episode of Web Material.
Likewise. It's good chatting to you, and good luck on your talk this week.
Yeah, thank you.